And we're holding on page Tes Zayin in Bava Kamma, the paragraph Daf Kuf Yud Amud Beis, middle of Os Mem Gimel. So in the parak again, most of the parak talks about Dinim of Gzela, which was just recently also in Shloshah Parakim of Rambam, and the end of it, near the end of the parak, talks a bit about Dinim involving Gezel HaGer. The Torah, normally a person steals from somebody, he repays it to him, he gives him back the thing, or repays him if he was coining the thing, as discussed throughout the parak. And if he himself is dead, then a born yid always has yoshin. So he'll give it to his children, or his grandchildren, or whatever, who inherited him. And if he didn't have children, then it goes to his father, and to his brothers, et cetera, the whole line of the whole details of Yerusha, as described in detail in the Sefer Bava Basra, which we'll get to in a couple of months, Rav Hashem. But then the Torah describes, the Torah says in Parshas Bamid, in Parshas Nasa, v'im ein lo ish goyo, if the person does not have a relative, then it goes to the Kohenim. How is it possible that a Yid does not have any relative? So it's explained that this refers to a Ger. He's not considered related anymore to his biological family, because he's Kikot Nishanolad. So, and if he, even if he's married, that doesn't help, because a wife doesn't inherit from her husband. In Halacha, the only way would be if he had children. So if he dies childless, then he has no Yoshim. So then the Pasuk says that the amount of Gzela has to be given to the Kohenim. Him, and the person also brings a korban asham as he would from other times where he stole and then swore falsely. So the Gemara spends some time, the Mishnah and the Gemara spend some time discussing the ins and outs of this din of Gezel HaGer. So eventually the Gemara gets into the following listing of the 24 Matnas Kahuna, of which the 24th is Gezel HaGer. Now the Gemara gets into it by way of a discussion, are these actually considered a matana to the Kohen, which has certain implications as far as halachas and maisa behem. So the Gemara says, Toshma, will prove as follows that in fact Gezel HaGer is considered a matana to the Kohen. The Braisa says, Chof Dalad Matnas Kohuna Nitnu L'Aaron L'Avonav, Aaron and his sons were given 24 Matnas Kohuna, V'kulam Nitnu B'Klal U'Prat U'Klal, all of them are given with a Klal U'Prat U'Klal. The Pasuk in Parashas Korach, where it lists most of them back to back, some of them it lists B'Feder, some of them you have Psukit, some of them you have words in a Pasuk which we darshan as referring to them, so it starts off with a Klal. Hashem says, I've given you all the holy things of the Jewish people that it should be for you for greatness. Then it starts listing them out individually, etc. And it lists out the various korbanos and the various other things that they're given, of which we're going to see how they're categorized. And then it finishes off with a klal at the end, all the things that are lifted off from the kodshim that are given by Bnei Yisrael are given to you, Aaron, and your descendants. So you have a klal of prato klal, ubris melach, and you also have a covenant of salt, meaning the same way as salt never spoils, the same way there's an eternal covenant that Hashem has with the Kohenim that they will receive these Matnas Kohuna. And the Pasuk actually says, Bris Melach Olam Hi Lifnei Hashem. So what's the point of that? Kol Mekayimon, a person who fulfills them, who gives the Kohenim their Matonis, Keilu Mekayim Klal Prato Klal Ubris Melach, can be considered as though he kept the entire Torah, which is much of the Torah, is Darshan with Klal Prato Klal. There are many dinim that we Darshan using that method, and the Torah. And he was Mekayim, all the Korbanos, of which it says by the Korbanos also it uses the same expression, Bris Melach, a covenant of salt, meaning again, an eternal covenant that the Eibishter has with us about them. Klal Prato Klal is like this. Many times the Torah will tell us a general statement, then some specifics, and then another general statement. And we direct, so to give an, here's an example. Yeah. Here's an example. The Torah tells us by Maisa Sheni, you take Maisa Sheni and you eat in Yerushalayim, and if you can't take it to Yerushalayim, because there's too much of it, then you exchange it for money and you take the money to your shalayim. Now, the Pasuk says, Menasata HaKesef, you should then spend the money in your shalayim, for anything that your soul desires. Now, that's a klal, that's a general statement. You could buy anything you want with it in your shalayim. Then you have a prat. Then the Torah lists certain things. You could use that money to buy cattle or sheep or wine or strong wine.
That's the prat.
That's a prat. That means that if it said only that, it would mean you could buy only those four things with my Sheni money. Then it continues, anything that your soul asks of you, which is again a klal, which would mean anything. So we doubt in it, a klal, a prato klal, we doubt in it then, That we have both. We have the prat, the specific four things that the Torah mentioned. Anything which is similar to them is what you can buy with Maaser Sheni money. So what do all those four things have in common? Two types of animals and two types of wine is all of them are vlodei sa'aret. They grow directly or indirectly from the ground. The wine grows from grapes that grow from the ground. The cattle and sheep eat grass which comes from the ground. So they have to be something that comes directly or indirectly from the ground, and that they're part of a rubber, that they produce offspring like themselves. You plant grape seeds or you plant a grapevine, and you plant a piece of a grapevine and you have a new grapevine. The sheep and the cattle produce new sheep and cattle. Is the expression. So that means, for example, you can't buy water with Maaser Sheni money. It's not part of a rubber. You know, it doesn't produce more water like itself. You can't buy salt. You can't buy mushrooms. They don't grow from the ground. They grow from the moisture in the air. The Gemara discusses in Eruvin, can you buy fish with them? Are fish considered, fish of course are part of a rubber, but are they considered vladis aret? Do they get nourished from something from the ground or not? The Gemara discusses that point. So that's an...
The second klal.
It's like this. We have a number among the in the Braisa of Rabbi Shmuel that we say every morning in davening. We have the rule klal mi klal or prat or mi prat or klal, and then we have klal or prat or klal. So it's like this. Sometimes the Torah will give us a klal, a general statement, and then it'll say a prat, a specific. That means then we darshan that we say ein beklal elamasha beprat. It means we do not pay attention to the klal, we only focus on the prat. The Torah says the prat, and therefore that's what it applies to, and exclusively that. Only the prat. Then you have the other way around, sometimes it'll say prat or klal, and then we ignore the prat, and we say it means not just the prat, but the entire klal. But when we have klal or prat or klal, then it means we have both. It means we focus on the prat, but it's not only the prat, we also broaden it into a category. Anything that can be in that category is now included. So like in this, anything that's similar to the prat, right? So like in this example, you can buy not only animals or wine with Maaser Sheni, but anything which is similar in being pre-mi-pre-vi gedulei aretz, right? So that's what the second klal accomplishes for us, right? So now when it comes to the 24 matnas kahuna, it's phrased in a klal of prat or klal way. So therefore, so that teaches us that it's similar in that regard to the whole Torah, which is often darshan with klal or prat or klal. Rashi on the Pasuk says it a little differently. Rashi on the Pasuk says that because this part about the 24 matnas kahuna is particularly precious, because it's Hashem reaffirming the validity of the kahuna after Korach and after all of that. So therefore, so it puts it in the form of klal or prat or klal to show how important it is. Anyway, but the point is, and here we're saying, the point of it is that shows that it's similar to the entire Torah, and it's similar to all the dinim of the korbanos, which are described as bris melach, a covenant of salt, and here these 24 matnas kahuna, of which some are from the korbanos, but some are not, is also described as bris melach. So call him a kaim on anybody who observes them and gives these matnas kahuna. Give him a kaim. Klal prat klal of bris melach is as if he's fulfilling the whole Torah, which is often darshan with klal prat klal, and as if he's offering all the korbanos, which are called bris melach. Call it over aleihen. Anybody who violates them and does not give them to the kohenim, kila over klal prat klal of bris melach, is as if he's violating the klal prat klal of the rest of the Torah, and as if he's violating the bris melach of the other korbanos. And they are the Elohim. Here's the list. Yud b'mikdash, 10 of them are given to the Kohanim in the Bes Mikdash, which means, Rashi explains, they have to be eaten lifnim min ha-kloyim, they have to be eaten within the Azara. Kloyim, strictly speaking, means curtains. We say every day in Ezer Mokoyim, rechol lifnim min ha-kloyim. In the Mishkan, they had curtains. In the Bes Mikdash, they had walls. There's actually here currently, I should mention, currently in Dafa Yomi, we're learning Perek Ezer Mekoyim, and tomorrow we finish it, Be'ez Hashem, but you have the expression that, you know, we say Ezer Mekoyim every day in davening. The various Rishonim explain that the reason is because Ezer Mekoyim is phrased, is written in a way like Halacha Moshe Mitzinai. There's no machlokas in it. There's no different opinions of Tanoim recorded in it. There are some of the details in it that are the subject of machlokas, the Gemara explains, but it's not mentioned in the Mishnayos themselves. And the Tiferes Yisrael points out the wording of it, like saying Lefnim Min HaKloyim is like the wording that they would have used back when they learned it in Moshe Rabbeinu's times, when in fact they had Kloyim. So therefore we say it every day as an appropriate introduction to davening. Anyway, so you have 10 of them in that have to be eaten in the Azara of the Beis HaMikdash. The Dalet B'Yerushalayim, another 4 that can be eaten anywhere in the city of Yerushalayim, the Yud B'Gvulin, and 10 of them that can be eaten or enjoyed anywhere throughout Eretz Yisrael, some of them even actually apply in Chutz La'aretz. So let's go through the list. Yud B'Mikdash, the 10 that take place that they have to eat in the Beis HaMikdash. Chatas Behema, anytime a person brings a regular person brings a chatas, then after the blood is sprinkled and they murim are offered on the Mizbeach, the Koyanim eat the rest of the meat. The chatas oif, the same thing when a person brings a bird as a chatas, the Koyanim eat it. And that, by the way, there's an interesting point in that. Unlike an animal korban, which is shechted, a bird korban is done malika. The Kohen uses his fingernail to cut through the back of the neck of the bird and to cut through the pipes in the neck. Normally, that would make a bird nevela. Normally, a person would not be allowed to eat it. Here, the Torah specially says that the Kohenim should eat it. So you have that. The osham vadai, then you have a person brings an osham for a definite purpose, of which you have the Mishnah there in Ezra Mekoyman lists 5 of them, asham gzelas, asham me'ilas, asham shikach harufa, asham nozir, asham metzora. Those 5 are all called vadai because those are all brought for a definite thing. Either the person definitely did the aveira, or the person is a nozir or metzora and is done with his, in the case of the metzora, he became tamei and now to start his nizirus over. In the case of the Mitzoda, he's done with his tzoras and is healed and goes back to normal society. So those are called Oshem Vadai. The Oshem Tolui, then you have the Oshem Tolui, where a person did something where he's not sure, where a person is not sure whether he did something which is Chayiv Koris. He had 2 things in front of him, one which would make him Chayiv Koris and the other one not, and he did or ate one of them and doesn't know which one it was. So Rashi points out all the Alshem Vadai, even though they're brought for specific reasons, Me'ilas, Zelas, etc., nevertheless they all count as one. The Alshem Tolui counts as a separate one. So therefore you have 4 so far. The Zivche Shalmei Tzibur, then you have the Shlomim of the Tzibur that are brought on Shavuos. On Shavuos, besides the regular Musafim, you also have the Shtei Alechem, 2 Chometz loaves, which are waved and given to the Kohenim. Along with them come a bunch of Korbanos, including you have 2 sheep that are brought as a Shlomim, and unlike a regular Shlomim that are brought by individuals, here they're brought by the Tzibur, and they're considered Kodshei Kodshim, and they're eaten only by the male Kohenim, only in the Azara. So you have those. The loig shemen shal metzora. Then you have the log of oil that a metzora brings with his korbanos. A metzora, when he's done his healed from his tzaras and goes through all the steps, then the last thing he does is he brings 3 korbanos. If he's rich, they're all 3 animals. If he can't afford it, then 2 of them are birds and 1 of them is a sheep. Along with it, he also brings a log of oil, where the Kohen takes some of the oil and sprinkles it in the direction of the Heichel. Then he applies some of it to the ear, to the ear and the right ear, the right thumb, and the right big toe of the Metzora. He puts some more of it on the Metzora's head, and then the rest of it is available for the Kohenim, and they can eat it anywhere in the Azara. So that's another gift for the Kohenim. Then you have the leftover of the Omer. The Omer is a type of mincha, but they take a koimetz from it and burn it on the mizbeach, like most menachos, and then afterwards the koyanim eat the rest of it. We have the shtei alechem that we just mentioned, the 2 chometz loaves that are brought on Shavuos, where they eat those as well. The lechem aponim, you have the lechem aponim that's placed on the shulchan weekly and then taken off the following Shabbos, and the koyanim eat it. Ushyore menachos, and the leftovers of regular menachos. Most menachos you have that a koimetz is taken from them, a handful is taken from them and burnt on the mizbeach, and the kohenim eat all the rest of it. So those are the 10 that are all in the azora, yud b'mikdash. The dalet b'Yerushalayim. Then you have 4 that can be eaten anywhere in your 4 of the matnas kahuna that can be eaten anywhere in Yerushalayim. Habachora, you have the bechor of an animal. So a person has a bechor, cow, sheep, or goat. He brings it as a korban, and then the kohenim can eat the meat of it anywhere in Yerushalayim. It's kodshim kalim. The bikurim that a person brings of his first fruits, those also, he brings them to the Beis Mikdash, he places them in front of his Beach, he waves them, he says the psukim, Arami Ovidavi, and all that, and then the Kohenim can take it and eat it anywhere in Yerushalayim. V'hamura min ha-toida v'el nazir. The third thing is the parts that are taken off from a toida and from the ram of a nazir. Namely, you have, when a person brings a korban toida, So he, along with it, he brings 40 loaves of bread. So now you have, first of all, the chos of a shoik, the breast and the thigh of the animal are taken and waved and then given to the kohen. And then you also have of the 40 loaves of bread. There's four, just 10 each of four types. One each of the four types is also taken and waved together with it and given, and those are all given to the kohen. So again, the Kohenim can now, those are Kodshik, Kodshim Kalim, and the Kohen can eat them anywhere in Yerushalayim, he and his family, as we say, in Ezra Mekoyman. Rashi points out the Torah and the El Nozer are counted as one because they're very similar. We learn them both, for they're both mentioned individually in the Pesukim, but they're both basically Shlomim. So they're both basically types of Shlomim, and they're both, the El Nozer also comes together with loaves of bread, 20 instead of 40, but other than that, they're basically the same thing, so therefore we count them all as one. And the fourth one is the Oris Kodshim, the skins of certain Kodshim, an Ola, a Chatas, or an Osham. Rashi points out the skins of Kodshim Kalam, of a Shlomim, or a Toda, or whatever, those go to the owner. Now, Rashi says, why are we counting these as Yerushalayim? On the face of it, they don't have to use specifically in Yerushalayim, they can then take it anywhere in Eretz Yisrael. But the answer is, we call them Yerushalayim because they come from the Korbanos. They're given out to them in Yerushalayim in the Beis Mikdash. However, we can't consider them as one of the ones from the Azara because the fact is they can use them anywhere. They don't just have to use them in the Mikdash. When we said the 10 in the Mikdash means 10 things that if they're taken out of the Azara will become possible. The skins are not in that category. Therefore, instead, we consider them in the category of Yerushalayim in the sense they're given out in Yerushalayim, but they can be then used anywhere else as well. Okay, so that's 14 so far. The Yud Begvulin, then you have 10 that take place, then you have 10 that are anywhere in Eretz Yisrael. And they are Truma from produce, or Trumas Meiser, you give Meiser Rishon to the Levi, and out of it he gives Trumas Meiser to the Kohen. The Chala, you make dough, you give Chala to the Kohen. The Reishis Hagez, you shear your sheep, you have to give a certain amount of the wool to the Kohen. The Matonis, you shecht a chulin animal, you have to give Zroyal Chayayim Bekeva to the Kohen. Some of these things, by the way, you have them. Some of these things do apply only in Eretz Yisrael, at least Midar Daisa, and maybe in countries near Eretz Yisrael, Dirabbanan, like Truma. Some of them, there's machloikas whether they apply in Chutz La'aretz or not. The Matonis, for example, Zeroy L'Chayayim V'Keva, many people are not careful about it and consider that the Gemara brings up the possibility that maybe it applies only in Eretz Yisrael. The halacha is actually that it applies anywhere, but many people are not careful about it, even in Chutz La'aretz for a variety of reasons, or even in Eretz Yisrael for a variety of reasons, person sure it is supposed to be. You're supposed to be giving it to the Kohen. Anyway, opinion of Ben, you give the 5 sloyim to the Kohen. Opinion Petachamur, you redeem a firstborn Petachamur with a sheep, and you give the sheep to the Kohen. Usdeyachuza, an ancestral field. The Torah describes in Parshas Bahar that if a person donates his field to Hekdesh, and this is a field that he inherited from his ancestor, is going back to the original conquest and division of Eretz Yisrael. So if he donates that field to Hekdesh, if he buys it back before Yovel, then good, it goes back to him and he keeps it. But if not, if when it comes Yom Kippur of Yovel, that field is still in the possession of Hekdesh, or they've sold it to somebody else, then instead, when it comes Yom Kippur of Yovel, no, like this, normally Yom Kippur of Yovel, fields go back to their original owners. In this case, the original owner is considered to be Hekdesh, and then it goes to the Kohenim, whose Mishmar includes every Mishmar of Kohenim serves for 1 week. So the Mishmar in which Yom Kippur of Yovel comes out are the ones who are going to be getting that field. So that's another one of the Matnas Kohenah. Then you have a person declares his field to be Cherem. There's actually 2 types of Cherem, Cherem LaGavoya and Cherem LaKoyanim. Here we're talking about Cherem LaKoyanim, where he says that this field will be Cherem for the Koyanim. Then it means it's another word for Hekdesh, so it has to be given to the Koyanim. You can't redeem it, unlike regular Hekdesh, you have to give it to the Koyanim. And the 24th one is the Gezel Ager, is this case where a person stole from a Ger and then swore falsely that he hadn't stolen. And then when he does Tshuva, again, the Ger has no Yoshim, so then he gives it to the Kohenim. That's the 24th of the Matnas Kohenah. So we see, in other words, the Gemara makes the point that therefore you see that they are actually called Matonis. It is actually called a gift to the Kohenim, which has certain implications as far as other areas of Halacha. Okay, The Rambam, by the way, when the Rambam brings this list in Hilchos Bikurim, he calls it Hilchos Bikurim Im Shar Matnas Korona Shemegvulin. It's Halachos Bikurim and other Matnas Korona that take place outside Yerushalayim. So he includes in Neochala and a couple of other ones. He enumerates them differently. He subdivides them differently. For example, the Rambam puts together. Instead of over here, we have Chatas Behema and Chatas Oif are counted as two separate ones. That Rambam, if I remember correctly, counts them as one big thing. They get to eat the Chatas. And then on the other hand, he subdivides some of the other ones, like, for example, the Toda and El Nazir count as two separate ones because they are two separate Korbanos. So he still arrives at 24, but he divides them differently. And then instead of 10, 4, and 10, he divides them into 8, 8, and 5, 8, 8, and 8, or something like that, or 8, 10, and whatever. I don't remember that. 8, 11, and 5, I think, or something like that. Whatever. Okay. Hagoizel Basra Perek Asiri. This Perek also continues on Dinim of Gzela. In the course of it, it talks about, it ends up talking about a matter involving moichsin. Moichsin are tax collectors. Now, back then, it wasn't like nowadays, you know, every person files their own individual taxes, and the IRS deals with you, or hopefully doesn't deal with you, on an individual basis. Back then, the way it generally worked was that, for example, the king or whatever government would decide that this country, this city or whatever, has to pay X amount in taxes. They would have a tax collector whose job it is to collect that. He would go and collect that money, and they would tell him, whatever you collect up to this amount, you have to give to the government. That's what we want as taxes for this place. You can collect more, and you can keep it for yourself. So the result was that, you can imagine, most tax collectors then were generally corrupt and would generally take a lot more than the government tells them to take, and therefore in general moichsim are considered to be robbers. Plus, on top of that, you have the government itself that tells the tax collector to collect taxes is not always necessarily considered a legitimate government. It's not always a government accepted by the people, where in halacha it's defined that if the people use the government's coinage, then they accept it as a legitimate government. And then, so the Gemara discusses this point. The government does have the right to tax, dinah de machos dinah, but the Gemara points out over here that you have, again, either a tax collector who collects more than he's supposed to, or where he just himself goes and starts collecting taxes without authorization from the government, is considered a gazlan, and then that has certain implications in halacha. So eventually the Gemara gets into the discussion then of, So if you have a tax collector or a toll collector, are you allowed to avoid him? Are you allowed to try evading paying the taxes? So if he's a legitimate tax collector, then you're not, because again, dinah d'machos dinah, and that would amount to stealing from the government, which you're not allowed to do. So that leads the Gemara into a whole discussion about the dinim of gezel agoy. So there's a long sugya on the subject. The Gemara discusses, is it osur, is it mutter? The end is that it's osur to steal from a goy even a tiny amount. And the Gemara discusses there are certain things. There's toros goy, there's avedas goy, whatever. But it's a whole long sugya. And one major point that's made in it is where there's a matter of chilul Hashem, then absolutely there's no room for playing games at all. If it's a matter of chilul Hashem, you always have to return even the tiniest amount. Worth telling, by the way, in this connection, a couple of things in that regard. So you have, again, you know, technically, for example, you have the loss of a goy or the toast of a goy sometimes is mutter. However, the Be'er HaGoyla on Shulchan Aruch points out, he says, I know people who took advantage of that kind of thing. They a goy made a mistake in a business transaction and they took advantage and didn't tell him. And even in cases maybe where it's allowed to, Alpi Halacha or things like that. He says some such people earned fortunes that way, but they ended up losing it all. It didn't end up staying with them because they got it to begin with in that dishonest way. There's also a story that's told involving Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. He was a rav in a little city in Lithuania in the years before World War II. One time, the local post office guy made a mistake and gave a yid too much change. And the yid goes and asks the rav, and the rav tells him you have to return it because toros goy is also except under certain limited circumstances. To make a long story short, and this happened a few times, and every time the rav would tell them you have to return it. To make a long story short, a couple of years later, when World War II broke out, this goy became one of the chassidim of the olam who helped yidden from that country to hide out and to escape, because he realized he had been shown to realize that Jews are honest to the nth degree, and then we should do everything we can to help them. Okay, so the Gemara in this connection brings the following piece. Amr of Bibi Bagidol, Amr of Shimon Chasida, Gezel Agoi Osir. It's also to steal from a Goi. The Amr of Huna, Minayim Le Gezel Agoi Shuhu Osir. How do we know that it's also to steal anything from a Goi? Shenema, the Pasuk says, V'achalta es kol ha'amim asher Hashem alekecha noisim loch. The Pasuk says, you will eat or you will consume all the nations that Hashem your God is giving you. Meaning, in other words, you're allowed to consume and take their property. Well, that means noisim loch. V'zman shem misurim biyodcha. When they're given over into your hand, meaning, in other words, when it's time of war and you're fighting against them, then you're entitled to take their property as spoils. The loy bezman she'enim mesurim biyodcha, but not when they're not given over into your hands, when you're living in the same country as them, and you're not actively fighting a war against them, then no, you're not allowed to give a chalta, anything of theirs. Marsha points out on the face of it, the Pasuk would be talking about the seven nations, about the seven Canaanite nations. However, the Gemara understands that it's talking about other nations that are similar to them, even if they're also corrupt and Ovdav and Azara and whatnot. The Pasuk is implying that only if you're actively fighting a war with them. Besides which, Marsha points out, after all, if it was the seven nations, it's not just V'achalta, it's not just that you can take their possessions, they themselves, V'isachaya kol neshama. So if the Pasuk is saying that you can take their possessions, then it has to be referring to other nations. You don't have the right to exterminate them, because that's only the seven nations, but you have the right, if you're fighting a war against them, then you have the right to take their property, but otherwise not. So from that we learn, says Reb Shimon Chasida, that Gezel Goy is also. Okay. A few blocks later, the Gemara talks about the matter of a matter called Achvuye, which means showing. So you can have a situation where sometimes you'd have where the government wants certain resources. Let's say, for example, they want hay for the animals for their army, or they want wine, let's say, to be giving their soldiers or whatever, and they would go around and requisition from people and demand that they give them hay or wine or whatever it is that they need. And then you would also have sometimes you'd have local gangsters and warlords would do the same kind of thing and go around to people and demand that you better give me this resource. Or you're going to be in trouble. So now the Gemara discusses there can be a situation, for example, where such a person, a government official or one of these local warlords or whatever, goes to a yid, goes to Reuven and tells him that we want such and such from you, and instead of giving them his own, he goes and shows them that Shimon has this thing, and they go and take Shimon's. This is called Achvuye. It's a form of Mesira. He's doing Mesira. He's being Moser, another Yid's property, over to Goyim. And that's a very serious thing. The Gemara discusses if you're not allowed to do that, and he's considered, at the very least, a Mazik, and afterwards is going to have to compensate Shimon, and it may even be more serious than that, as we're going to see in the Gemara over here. One point is, the Rosh makes a point in that connection, which unfortunately has been borne out again and again in Jewish history, that very often what happens is, when they find it the first time, they're not going to be satisfied with that. They're going to go and harass the guy again and again, and maybe even end up throwing him in jail, or who knows, even worse, because they're going to try to extort from him again and again. So therefore, that's why this matter of Mesira is such a serious thing. It's not just a matter of they're going to just take from him once, and then that's it. It's likely to happen again and again, and the guy is likely to get in bigger and bigger trouble with the goyim. Nowadays, when in principle we live in, and most of us live in countries where there is the rule of law, so posts can discuss in what cases there are certain cases. The fact is, even in earlier Poskim, it discusses there are certain limited cases where Mesira is allowed when a person is a danger to the public, and they talk about it nowadays and in various connections when there may be certain cases when Mesira is appropriate, when we, among other things, when we know that the Goyish legal system is not going to go beyond, is not going to do like the Rosh and extort the, like the Rosh says, and extort the guy again and again, but it's complicated. Anyway, so the Gemara tells the following story. There was a certain person who planned to do that. He planned to show the local goy, the local goyish officials or warlords or whatever, something that somebody else had, so that they'd go and take it from that other person. He wanted to show that somebody else had a pile of straw, a pile of hay, that then they could go and take for their purposes. Also, he came to Rav, the pastor, the other guy, brought him to a din Torah in front of Rav to prevent it from happening. So Rav tells him, you're not allowed to. Loy tachve v'loy tachve. You're not allowed to show him. why the double expression. Ben Yoyada says it means, in other words, that you're not allowed to show him, you're not allowed to show the legitimate government people, you're not allowed to show the illegitimate government people, basically. So whether we're talking about that this is a legitimate government thing, or whether we're talking about that this is a local mafia guy or whatever, either way, you're not allowed to do it. Omale machvino machvina. The guy's a chutzpanyak. He says, no, I'm going to show and I'm going to show. Yosef Rav Kahana kamed Rav. Rav Kahana at that point was sitting as a Talmud in front of Rav. And when he heard the guy talk like that, like a chutzpanyak like that, shamte lekue mine. He pulled out his neck from him, meaning in other words, he broke the guy's neck and killed him. Now there are was he supposed to do that? So actually let's talk about the next couple of lines in the Gemara and we'll see whether Rav Kahana was right in doing that. Kori Rav Ilavei. Rav applied the following pasuk to what Rav Kahana had just done. The pasuk says, "Bonayich ulfu shochu b'roish chutzay kisoy michmo." The Navi says to the Jewish people, and specifically to Yerushalayim, your children are fainting. They're lying and they're lying around in all of the streets. Kisoy michmar, like a toy, which is a type of wild animal, a wild bull. Michmer that's caught in the net. So Pashat Pshat means exactly like that. The Navi is saying, look at what's happening to the Jewish people in all their years in Golos. Many times they're being trapped by the Goyim and they're like a wild animal trapped in a net and helpless. But what's the comparison? Rav says, Ma toy ze kivin shenofel b'michmer ein merachmin olav. When a toy, when this wild bull or buffalo or whatever falls into a net, nobody has rachmanas on it. They just go and they go and shecht it. The same way, the comparison is, when money of Jews falls into the hands of Goyim, in Merachmanolov, they no longer have Rachmanos on him. Again, like the Rosh says, they're going to keep on extorting from him again and again. So Rashi says, in other words, therefore, so Rav is in effect saying to Rav Kahana, you did good by killing this guy, because he was a danger, he was threatening to go and master on a fellow Yid, and it wouldn't have just ended with the straw, it would have continued from there, that other Yid would have been in worse and worse trouble with the government or with these mafia nicks or whatever, and therefore you were right in killing him. With that said, there are different discussions among Mephoshim about that. There is actually an extra, Ben Yehoyada, I think, says it's maybe not necessarily that he intended deliberately to kill him. He made this meant to hit him, to stop him, and then he hit him accidentally so hard that he killed him. But there is further discussion. I mean, just because the guy said he's going to master the Rashba and the Marshal bring up a point. Wait a minute, just because he said he's going to master, that's reason enough for Rav Kahana to kill him. If we assume he killed him deliberately, you have a concept. The Gemara sometimes says that over the inish gozim. Sometimes a person will exaggerate. Sometimes a person will bluff and say I'm going to do such and such, and he doesn't actually intend to do it. So it could mean that this guy had previously had a chazaka of doing this kind of thing. It's possible that this guy had done it before. However, the Rashba and the Yamshul Shlomo say here you don't really need that. The guy spoke in such a chutzpahtik way when Rav tells him loy sechvi, veloy sechvi, do not show it, do not show it. And the guy says machvino, machvino, I'm going to do it. That's such a chutzpahnyak. We can assume that he's actually going to follow through with it and do it. And therefore Rav Kahana can be correct in proactively killing him. But again, it doesn't even necessarily have to mean that he deliberately killed him, but rather maybe that he wanted to just hit him and he accidentally ended up killing him. He accidentally ended up hitting too hard. Oh, Ben Yehoyada says, actually, it's not when he says, v'loy techvi, it's not two different kinds of goyim. He says, sometimes you have ones where they just say, we're going to take it from you, and we're not going to even pay you for it. And then you have others where we say, you better give us the straw now. At some later date, we'll pay you. But even those, not necessarily, they're going to have to follow through with it. So Rav is telling the guy, loy techvi, don't show whether they're actually saying we plan to take it without compensation, or even if they claim they're going to compensate because they're just lying. And the guy says, machvina, I'm going to show either group. So then we're saying that Rav Kahana killed him. Now, omale Rav le Rav Kahana. Now then Rav says to Rav Kahana as follows. You know, there's a difference in the government here in Babel. The story took place in Babel. Up until now, you had the Persians ruling over Babel, and they weren't so particular on Shvichos Damim. A person killed, okay, you know, they figure it's a matter between the two parties, the government doesn't have to necessarily get involved. The hashta iki yivanoi, but now there are Greeks, dekapti ashvichus damim, who are more particular about shvichus damim. They consider it a government matter. They consider it a crime, not just a matter between private people. The amri, so they're going to start yelling murodin, murodin, murder, murder, and they're you're going to be in trouble with the government for having killed. Now, what was going on over here? So Tosfos actually points out there were other Gemaras that implied that this was the period when the Persians were actually taking over Babel, but Tosfos said, fine, there may have been some government officials there who were Greeks. Historically, what you have is there was a period of time, a few hundred years before that, there was a government that ruled over Persia and also Babel. They were Persians, but they were kind of lax as far as their religion and as far as other things. They absorbed a lot of cultural ideas from the Greeks and whatnot. And yeah, they tended to consider this kind of thing. Pliny kills Pliny, fine, you know, work it out between yourselves kind of thing. Now you have, in this time that we're talking about, another Persian family had taken over the government, and they were a lot more fanatical about their religion. We find in various places in the Gemara, and they were also apparently a lot more, They took this kind of thing of murder and crimes like that a lot more seriously. So now Rav says to Rav Kahana, you're likely to be in trouble with the government because of this. If they find out that you killed this guy, then you might be arrested. So he tells him, Kum sak la'arad Yisrael. Oh, I forgot to mention, Marashar explains when Rav quoted the pasuk Kisoy Michmer, okay, it means an animal caught in a trap. But why dafka a toy? Out of all the possible kosher animals, why the comparison to a toy? He says because a toy, again, is some kind of wild ox or something. Many poskim identify it as a buffalo. And there's a question. We know that you have to do kisi adam for a wild animal, but not for a domestic animal. Do you have to do kisi adam when you shech the buffalo? There's a machlokas among the poskim. Many hold that you do not. Well, therefore, that's the comparison over here. That was saying you don't even have, at least kisi adam is an expression of a degree of rachmanus towards the animal. You spilled its blood, don't leave it in a puddle on the ground. Cover it up out of respect for the life of the animal. And here we're saying on the other hand, a toy is, according to most poskim, you don't have to cover the blood. So that's the comparison. They have absolutely no rachmanus, just like a person shechts a toy, a person shechts a buffalo, and has absolutely no, doesn't even show the basic rachmanus of covering up the blood. So he tells him, so now he says again, you're going to be in trouble with the government. Kum sak la'arad Yisrael, get up to Eretz Yisrael from Babel, the Kabbalah Loch, and when you're there in Eretz Yisrael, accept on yourself the Tikshi, the Rabbi Yochanan Shevashnin, that you won't ask Kashas to Rabbi Yochanan, who was the head of the central yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, for the next 7 years. Now, what's going on over here? Marashar explains this is not for a matter of tshuva. Because after all, Rabbi just told him that he acted properly in killing this would-be Moser. So Marashar explains that the fact is, though, one thing that Rav Kahana did do wrong, he didn't ask Rishus before he did it. He should have asked Rishus from Beis Din. Here he had Rav was there. So he should have asked permission from Rav before killing the guy. Now, he didn't do that. That's considered like murder halacha b'fnei Rabbi. That's like, in effect, paskening halacha in the presence of his Rebbe without asking him. And the Gemara, in a number of places, mentions that this is a very serious thing, and it can make a person chayav misa. So therefore, so Rav is telling him, therefore, you have to accept on yourself golus, and even when you're in front of Rabbi Yochanan, for the next 7 years, which is one-tenth of a person's life, you should not ask him kashas in the Beis Medrash. Just sit there quietly and absorb what he has to say, and pretend, in other words, Marashar explains, he's telling him symbolically, pretend as though you're, for the next 7 years, pretend as though you're a newborn. And it takes 7 years before a baby before a child is even old enough to learn Torah and ask kashas and be brought to cheder. So symbolically, consider yourself like you were reborn now, and for the next 7 years, you're as if like you're a baby, and you're not of the level to be asking kashas in the Beis Medrash yet. So not so much a matter of kapara for the killing itself, but a kapara to that degree for the fact that you were murder halacha b'fnei Rabbi. So there are different other mafoshim talk about other reasons why Rav told him to do this. Another point, Yun Yaakov makes another point after all, maybe he could have prevented the guy in a lesser way. Maybe he didn't have to. Maybe he didn't have to kill him. Maybe he could have wounded him and prevented him from mastering like that. So therefore, the same way as we find, let's say, by Kayin, Shavasayim Yukam. So the same way, Rav is telling him for 7 years, you need to be quiet. Okay. Ben Yehoyada makes another point as well. Listen, if he's going to be going to Eretz Yisrael, he's going to be living in a Makom Torah, so there's no tsar involved in that. So therefore, so for it to be tsar, it has to be that you're not going to ask Rabbi Yochanan's questions for 7 years, meaning that you have the ability to be participating in the discussions in the Beis Medrash, and you're not going to do that, and you're going to have to pretend as though you don't know. For you, that'll be the tsar. That way, your golus will be fully mechaper for you. Okay. So, Ozel, so he went to Eretz Yisrael, and he found, when he came to the Beis Medrash, he found Rish Lakish was sitting there and finishing off that day's teaching with the Chachamim. What happened was, you had Rabbi Yochanan was the Rosh Hashiva there in Eretz Yisrael. Rish Lakish was his second in command, his assistant. So every day, Rabbi Yochanan would give a shiur to the Talmidim. Afterwards, Rabbi Yochanan would leave, and Rish Lakish would sit with the Talmidim and clarify all the points for them, and they would discuss it among themselves. Think of like you have a Fabringin of the Rebbe, and afterwards you had Rabbi Yoel, all of Ashalom would sit over there with the Choyzerim. So Rish Lakish, in effect, was Rabbi Yochanan's Choyzer. So Rav Kahana walks into the Beis Medrash when Rish Lakish is doing the Chazara. So he asks the Chacham over there, where's Rish Lakish? It's not, he didn't know what he looked like after all. So the other Talmidim asked him why. So he says, Hai Kusha, Hai Peruka. He starts saying, I have this question and I have that question, and I have this answer and I have that answer. So in other words, I overheard Rish Lakish explaining to the Talmidim. Now fine, Rav told me not to ask Rabbi Yochanan. He didn't say I can't ask anybody else. But you should know that there's certain questions and certain answers that we have to point out in what Rish Lakish was just reviewing with you guys. Omrulele Rish Lakish. They told Rish Lakish, these are what's going on. So Rish Lakish in turn goes and reports to Rabbi Yochanan. He says, Ari Olam Mibavel, a lion, an outstanding Talmid Chacham, has come up from Bavel. La'ayin Ma'ab, Mesiv Dilamachar, Rebbe, tomorrow, check over very carefully what you're going to be teaching in the Mesivta, because you have this great Talmid Chacham, and if you leave anything unclear or anything like that, or anything questionable, he's going to pick it apart with his questions. He didn't know, of course, that Rav had told Rav Kahana not to do that. So better prepare your shiur carefully tomorrow. And what happened after that, we'll continue tomorrow, Beis Hashem. Yom Yom Mashiach Ugo'ola, Yudches Chedren. The Rebbe was talking about, the Rebbe talks about in an Igeris from the years before the Nesios, that for the first installment was actually in yesterday's Yom Yom Mashiach Ugo'ola, but we talk about when it comes to the promises of La'asid Lover, yeah, there's Yemosa Mashiach, there's Gan Eden, and there's the world after Tchias HaMesim. So you have Yemosa Mashiach, there's the different opinions, whether it's going to be a time of Nisim, or whether it's going to be Ein Ben Olam Hazeh Yemosa Mashiach, El Shibud Malchus Bilvad. So that means either way, of course, there's definitely going to be eating and drinking at that point. You see that from many psukim, and Maamar Chazal and the Rambam says that explicitly. Now we come to the second one, Gan Eden. Gan Eden is where you have Neshamas without bodies. So then, of course, there's no eating and drinking over there, because Neshamas don't eat and drink. Then you come to the world after Tchias HaMesim. Now, so that's going to be neshamas in bodies. There is the opinion of the Rambam that Tchias HaMesim is only a temporary way station, and then after that, eventually everybody dies, and you have a world of only neshamas. But the Ramban holds that after Tchias HaMesim, people will continue to live forever, and the Alter Rebbe in Likutei Torah agrees with that. So then there's going to be neshamas in bodies, and when Chazal say, Ha'olam Abba, Ein Bo Lo Yachil V'Lo Shtia, then Olam Abba, there's no eating and no drinking, of necessity, then they're talking about the ultimate schar, that's talking about Olam HaTchiyah. So even though we'll be neshamas in bodies, there won't be eating and drinking, because at that point we'll be nen in Meziv HaShchina, we're going to be nourished by the radiance of the Shechina, rather than by physical eating and drinking. Okay. In the Alter Rebbe's Shulchan Aruch, we're beginning in Madura Basra Simen Gimel, which is the halachas of going to the bathroom. So we talked about at the end of the previous simon, or throughout the simon, the idea of a person not uncovering his body more than necessary, even when he's getting dressed and undressed, etc. So now, when a person goes into the bathroom, also he has to be tzniyistik. In fact, the Gemara has an expression, ein koden tzanua, elo misha tzanua beveis akisir. Who do you call somebody who's really tzniyistik? Somebody who acts in a tzniyistik way in the bathroom. Because again, nobody's watching except the Eivishter. If he acts even there in a tzniyistik way, you know that he really has that awareness that Hashem is always watching him. So that means, even in the bathroom, a person should only uncover himself as much as necessary, and only when he needs to. So therefore, a person shouldn't uncover himself until he sits down, to be exact. I mean, with our modern-day toilets, maybe that's not exactly possible, but at least, in other words, as close as possible to when he sits down. How much should he uncover? Behind him a tefach, and in front of him two tefachim. Why more in the front? Because the urine squirts out. On the other hand, there's a girsa the other way around. Now, there's a girsa the other way around, that the girsa, as we have in front of us in the Gemara, is like that, a tefach in back and two in front, but then the tur and the rosh and Rabbeinu Yonah have the girsa the other way around. And that's as far as a man. As far as a woman, nothing in front of her because of her anatomy. There's no squirting. And behind her, one or two tefachim, depending on the different girsas. Lamaisa, basically, because you don't know which is the correct girsa, so just minimize it as much as possible, how much is uncovered. Okay. And we'll continue with more dinim about that tomorrow, Baruch Hashem.
Yeah.
Yeah.